Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Francine welcome Dr. Harriet Kluger. Dr. Kluger is an associate professor of medical oncology and a member of the Yale Cancer Center Melanoma Program.
So why don't we start off by describing what is melanoma?
Melanoma is cancer that normally originates in the skin. We all have pigmented cells inside our skin. That's what gives our skin its skin color. Sometimes these cells tend to cluster and then you get moles. So melanoma typically arises from these pigmented cells, either from a mole or in an area where there was no pre-existing mole. It can also, however, come from areas that are not exposed to the sun, such as the palms of the hands and the feet, underneath the nail beds, the mouth, the perianal area, and so on.
So how common is melanoma?
Well, it's interesting. Melanoma is a disease that's increasing the most among all the cancers over the past 5 decades. About 62,000 new cases are diagnosed every year in the United States, up from around 40,000 20 or 30 years ago.
I think I know the answer to this question, but what really causes melanoma?
Well, there's a genetic component and there's also an environmental component. And the worst environmental component is sun exposure or exposure to any kind of UV radiation, such as tanning parlors and so on.
And so what accounts for this significant increase that we've been seeing in melanoma? Is it because, the youngsters out there are kind of worshiping the sun a little bit too much and we have too many tanning parlors?
Well, we think that's definitely a contributing factor. The other contributing factor is the increased awareness. So people are going to the dermatologist and we're finding more. And some of these melanomas may in fact not be fatal, but one never knows. So people are going to the dermatologist, getting things removed that perhaps 20 or 30 years ago would have gone undetected. But the incidence of death from melanoma is also going up, and I think that is the strongest evidence that it's a true increase in the incidence, not just an increase in diagnoses. Most likely cause is the change in our lifestyle. People spend more time outside. People spend more time on sailboats, go on vacation to the equator. People with fair skin probably have no business living in very warm places, but, that's what's happened over the past couple of 100 years. So, in fact, the country that has the most melanoma in the world is Australia. Main reason is that you've got a bunch of people of Irish descent and fair skin who are living near the equator, and they're outdoors a lot.
Now, what about here in the state of Connecticut, which obviously doesn't have the same degree of, sunlight exposure as, say, Florida, Arizona, or Australia?
Yes, so the incidence in the Northeast is slightly lower than places like Arizona and Texas, but apparently the ozone layer is a little bit thinner over Connecticut, so there actually is a fair amount of radiation over here despite our latitude.
So can you talk about exposure in terms of when in life you're at the highest risk? Because people have said that the exposure that you have as a child really predisposes you later on in life to develop these kinds of skin cancers.
Right. So that's one of the theories. The problem is that it's very hard to prove that theory. So there are a couple of population studies that have looked at migration of people from one place to another. So, for example, there was a study that was done in Israel on people who were born to Orthodox families, Orthodox Jewish families, where they tend to be very well covered. And they've compared that population of patients to people who were born in secular families and are out on the beach a lot. Then there was a third population of patients who became Orthodox when they were around 20 years old. So it turned out that the incidence of melanoma among the patients among the people who became Orthodox at age 20 was about the same as those that were born to the secular families. But the study was relatively small, and there have been a couple of other similar studies. It's very hard to prove it. Now, we also don't know for sure that what somebody does when they're 30 isn't going to influence the skin at age 60 or 70 now that people are living longer. But certainly exposure at a young age is probably the biggest risk factor for melanoma.
You talked about melanoma occurring in non-sun-exposed areas of the body. So how do we really explain that?
It's probably just like any other cancer for which we don't really know why it happens. It's something called a spontaneous mutation in a gene. Something goes wrong for reasons that we can't explain. But there are no known risk factors for the non-sun exposed areas of melanoma. There are a couple of genes that have been shown to be abnormal in patients who tend to get melanoma all over their bodies, but it's normally skin melanoma.
And what would be the kind of the most common age at which that risk for melanoma is the highest?
Well, people get melanoma at all ages. It's now become the most common malignancy diagnosed in women in their 30s, men in their 40s. But diagnoses happen at all times. The peak incidence is around 60. But that's because we just have people who are living longer now.
So, Harriet, can you talk a little bit about what patients should look for? Because, you know, we all have these pigmented lesions, these things that we call moles and birthmarks. So how do we know whether or not we need to worry about those?
Yeah, so there's something called the ABCDE criteria, and we're going for F as well right now. A stands for asymmetry, so any mole that's asymmetric. B is a border, so if the border is irregular as opposed to a regular border. C is color. So a lesion that has got more than one color in is suspicious for something that's becoming malignant. D is diameter, the diameter of over a half a centimeter, which is, I guess, around a quarter of an inch, is more likely to be malignant. E is elevation of the lesion. And F actually stands for funny looking. So I know that's a very poor description, but anything that's just changing and looks strange. Now, I actually asked my dermatologist who has, this is Dr. Suguru Imaida, who has a personal interest in screening and diagnosing melanomas, how often he's surprised by a melanoma. And he said approximately once a month he removes something that he didn't really think was going to be a melanoma in the first place. It's sometimes very, very difficult. And the hardest ones to diagnose are those that have no pigment at all. They're called amelanotic melanomas. They tend to be pink. And most often the patient will bring those lesions to the dermatologist's attention because they're bleeding, they're itchy, or they're just a little bit uncomfortable for some or other reason.
And Harry, what colors should one be particularly concerned about?
Black and something that's changing. So more than one color within a lesion. So things that are uniformly brown are normally benign.
So does it make any difference whether it's actually a bump or whether it's a flat lesion?
There are some melanomas that are actually flat too. So just to add to the confusion, bumps are, generally speaking, more likely to be malignant, but a flat lesion that's changing, especially those that are big.
And if anyone has, say, a funny-looking lesion,
The F criteria.
What should one then do?
Well, one should go to a dermatologist and have it biopsied. Family doctors can biopsy it as well. It just depends on the person's ability to access health care. People who have fair skin and people who have a family history of melanoma should be seeing a dermatologist at least once a year for screening, just like people should have a pap smear once a year and a breast exam once a year and so on.
Mm-hmm. So can this occur in children as well?
Yes, we rarely see melanomas in children. Those tend not to be related to sun exposure.
What about once a patient knows that they have a melanoma after it's been excised by the dermatologist? What happens next?
So once they're told that it's truly a melanoma, we do something called a wide local excision. We take skin around the lesion just in case a couple of cells have escaped. And this, I don't do it, but the surgeons do it. And over the years, this has dramatically decreased the likelihood of recurrence within that same area. So they do a wide local excision. And then if the depth is greater than a certain depth and has a greater level of invasion to the structures within the skin, we'll also remove lymph nodes in the area that drain that particular lesion.
And the surgeon who would do this operation is a surgeon who really specializes in skin cancer?
Correct. So in some places, it's surgical oncologists that do it. In other institutions, it's plastic surgeons. At Yale, we have plastic surgeons that typically do this. And the two surgeons that are most focused on it, Dr. Arian and Dr. Narayan, really spend all of their time doing melanoma-related surgeries.
So how often are these melanomas spread?
At the time of diagnosis, it's around 10% have spread to other organs, so either the lymph nodes or internal organs. So most of them are diagnosed as skin only.
So does a patient need blood work and CAT scans if they have a diagnosis of melanoma?
It depends on the depth of the melanoma, on whether the melanoma is ulcerated. There are a few other features that the pathologists look at under the microscope to help us determine what we call the risk of recurrence. So typically, if the risk of recurrence or metastasis is higher than around 20 or 30%, we will get CAT scans on patients. If it's around 20%, we do a chest X-ray periodically, and if it's less than 20%, we tend not to do it. Blood work we do as well periodically on these people, and sometimes we pick up metastases by blood work.
Now, Harriet, when would a patient be referred to see you and to get your input as to what should be done?
That, too, is somewhat institutional dependent. Over here, we tend to follow the patients when they have earlier lesions because the surgeons are so busy and we really want them to spend the time doing these wonderful surgeries that they do on the patients. Therefore, the oncologist will follow the patients a little more frequently than at some other places in the country. Generally speaking, I think anything over 2 millimeters in depth, at Yale it's over 1 millimeter in depth, with ulceration, depth of invasion, and lymph node involvement, certainly we would follow as well.
And in fact, the melanoma group, of which you're one of the senior members, has a team of doctors that gets together and discusses many of the cases.
Yes, it's actually the highlight of our week. We call it Melanoma Breakfast Club. Every Thursday morning at 8:30, we get together with a dedicated pathologist, Dr. Demetrius Braddock from Surgical Pathology. Dr. Marcus Bosenberg is a dermatopathologist who's a new recruit to the melanoma program. He's also a lab researcher. We have the two surgeons that come in, Drs. Arian and Narayan. Medical oncologist Dr. Schnoll, Dr. Len Farber from the community group, and Dr. John Ree also attend. And we have radiologists and an additional dermatopathologist who comes along. We tend to discuss patients. There's sometimes difficulties with management. So it's an excellent forum for us to interact with each other. At least once a week. We also have the opportunity to discuss research programs, clinical trials. It's a wonderful conduit for getting things from the lab translated quickly into the clinic and vice versa.
And I would think that obviously having this multidisciplinary team approach really is a great opportunity for patients to get the input of everyone so that they really get the best treatment plan.
Yes, and I think, you know, we all have different opinions. We don't always reach a consensus, but that's correct, that for a specific patient coming in to see one oncologist, if the patient gets presented then at the tumor board, they may be getting second opinions from another three or four people. For us as well, when it's not a clear cut what needs to be done, it's very nice to be able to discuss the patient with the group.
So we talked a little bit about how we diagnose melanoma and the tests that we do to see whether or not it's spread. So if it does spread outside the skin, generally where do we find it? Where does it metastasize?
So the rule with melanoma is that all bets are off. It can go anywhere and at any time, and we never cease to be surprised. We've seen things come back 22 years later, 25 years later. We've seen melanoma go to odd places like the small bowel, the spleen, and so on. The most common sites of metastasis are within the skin, either between the melanoma and the lymph nodes that drain that area, within lymph nodes, either in that area or elsewhere. The lung is another common site. The most difficult sites to treat are the liver and the brain.
So do you ever do surgery on these metastases?
Yes. There is some evidence that if a patient has a single metastasis, removing that metastasis probably improves survival of the patient. So we definitely do try to go after isolated metastases surgically when possible.
So it sounds like a patient who's had a melanoma pretty much has to worry about that for the rest of their life.
Yes, unfortunately. Patients have to then basically incorporate the follow-up and the concern into their lives. It becomes part of whom they are and how they do it. And it's somewhat stressful for some people. But, you know, with time they get used to it. And I always try to tell patients to put this into perspective. So if it's a 1 millimeter melanoma with a 10% chance of recurrence, the risk of that recurrence isn't really much greater than getting breast cancer or colon cancer. It's certainly smaller than the risk of getting heart disease. So unfortunately, we have a lot of things that we need to worry about. about in life, and it just gets added to the to that list.
And Harriet, the follow-up would be with the dermatologist, the medical oncologist, the surgeon, or a little bit of everyone?
Well, we try to make it as easy for the patients as possible. The follow-up with the dermatologist is predominantly to look for a second melanoma. So once a person has had one melanoma, the chance of getting a second one over their lifetime is around 10%. The dermatologists are just so much better than we are at looking at these lesions on the skin and in all the odd locations that melanoma can pop up. The follow-up with us is to look for recurrence of that particular melanoma. And we work with the surgeons so that the patients follow up either with us or with the surgeons, but we really don't duplicate that.
So does it make any difference for a patient once they've already had a melanoma to start avoiding sunlight? In other words, can you decrease your risk of developing a second melanoma by decreasing your exposure to ultraviolet radiation?
We don't actually know that for sure. There's no strong evidence that not going out in the sun makes a difference once somebody has had one melanoma. But particularly if it's a young patient, one wouldn't want to take that risk, because if you have a 30-year-old with one melanoma who goes out in the sun, maybe that'll impact something that happens in 30 years later.
So the message is to continue to use your sunscreen.
Well, that's a whole different topic. Does sunscreen really make a difference?
Thank you very much for this part of the discussion. You're listening to the Yale Cancer Center Answers Show, and we're here discussing melanoma with Dr. Harriet Kluger.
There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing cancer treatment is very exciting, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. After treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships can be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu. And Dr. Harriet Kluger, a medical oncologist at Yale Cancer Center, is our guest today. So, Harriet, we were just talking a little bit about sunscreen and the fact that even if one's had a melanoma, one potentially could decrease their risk of secondary melanomas later on in life by using sunscreen. So what's your recommendation to your patients?
I tell my patients to take maximal precautions, and it's not just the patient, it's their family members and particularly their children. You asked earlier about sunscreen. So there have been a couple of studies where they showed that, in fact, in the communities that use sunscreen first in the United States, in the southern states, the incidence of melanoma went up, while the incidence of basal cell cancer and squamous cell cancer really declined dramatically. And the thought is that people don't burn that much anymore because they use sunscreen, and that probably sunscreen does help to decrease the risk, but people get this false sense of security and they spend more time outdoors. So we really recommend covering yourself with clothing, hats, and so on, and trying not to go out in the sun in the middle of the day, but rather going to the beach in the early morning and late afternoon. And we look at the sunscreen as the last line of protection against the sun. It's not clear whether it makes much difference if you go up on the SPF above 30. We think that any additional SPF probably makes very minimal difference.
It's interesting because I think we very rarely see dermatologists who have that bronze tan. They usually are pretty pale, and they seem to follow their own advice, I think.
I think so. I certainly follow my own advice.
We didn't touch on this, but I think it's an important point, and that is patients who have dark skin, African-American patients, mm-hmm. and other populations with dark skin, are they at the same risk for melanoma, and should they follow the same precautions with sunscreen?
We do see African-American and Hispanic patients with melanoma. It's not all that common, but we see them. Normally, it's in non-sun-exposed areas, so probably doesn't really have anything to do with sun exposure. So African-Americans have much lower risk. They probably do not have to follow the same precautions as Caucasians. Hispanic people, you know, their skin color can actually vary a lot. In Southern Connecticut, we have a lot of Italian people, and we see our fair share of olive skin skin-colored people who actually have melanoma. So I would say that these precautions should be used for everybody, perhaps with the exception of very, very dark-skinned people.
Now here, let's maybe get back to, you know, the different treatment options. So if a patient has metastatic melanoma, melanoma that's spread to various organs, what would be the typical approach that you'd recommend?
We treat every patient individually. It does depend on the patient's age, their other medical problems, where the disease is, and we sort of have a risk assessment of how aggressive we want to be and whether the treatment is going to be worse for an individual patient than the disease. So some patients have relatively slow-growing melanoma and might actually live for a long time with their metastatic melanoma, even if we do nothing. So for those patients, we don't really want to take out all of our big guns and give them aggressive therapy that might actually make them worse off. But certainly younger patients, patients who have no heart disease, no lung disease, we try to go for aggressive therapy. Our standard approach at Yale is that if a patient has what we call a good performance status, in other words, they're very functional, and a patient that has no other medical problems, specifically no heart disease and no lung disease, we give them a therapy called high-dose interleukin-2. That's an inpatient therapy. It's difficult to tolerate. The cancer center over here is the only place in the state that actually gives it, as far as I know, and or gives it frequently. And with that, we actually have a cure rate. The cure rate is relatively small, but we do have patients that we treated many, many years ago who've never had a recurrence. So that's the first thing that we try. If that doesn't work, we then try multiple other things. There's an experimental therapy called ipilimumab.
That's a mouthful.
Yes, quite the mouthful. But it's a very interesting drug that's being developed by Medarex and Bristol-Myers. And hopefully that one will be FDA approved soon, because there we're seeing a similar phenomenon. We have a subset of patients who are treated 4, 5, 6 years ago and have not had a recurrence. There are a number of side effects that go along with it, but certainly we have a share of patients who are doing well.
So Harriet, these are both immunotherapies. Can you comment a little bit about the role of immunotherapy in this disease and explain a little bit about what these immunotherapies really are?
Right. So these two therapies are what we call nonspecific immune therapies. What they really do is they rev up the immune system in a general fashion, and then you hope that the immune system will fight the melanoma. When you do that, you also get something called autoimmune disease, where the immune system is starting to attack parts of the body that it really shouldn't be attacking, like the bowels. People can get diarrhea, they can get rashes, and sometimes these side effects can be fairly severe. There are other more specific immune-based therapies where one gives either a vaccine at the same time to a certain protein, or you can remove immune cells from the body and sensitize those cells outside of the body, then put them back into the patient. But you sensitize them to the patient's own melanoma or to specific proteins that are only present in melanoma cells. Those therapies we're not really doing much right now of at Yale, but we certainly hope to do them further in the future.
So a couple of these treatments, interleukin-2 and interferon, are substances that our bodies make.
Correct.
So why is it that our bodies aren't able to fight against these tumors if they make these substances?
We're just not making enough. Because if we were making lots of interferon and interleukin-2 all the time, we would be walking around all day long as if we had the flu. So when one has the flu, part of what one feels, like the fevers and the fatigue and the muscle aches, are not from the influenza virus itself. It's from the body responding to that. And that's essentially what we do when we give these therapies. Patients do feel like they have the flu. They get fevers. They don't feel well. But if you're doing that in a controlled setting for a limited period of time, it's tolerable and doable.
Harriet, as you know, both Dr. Foss and I were at the National Cancer Institute many, many moons ago where interleukin-2 was developed. But back then, actually, everyone who received that treatment had to be admitted to the intensive care unit, and patients got really sick. As I understand it, you and Dr. Snoll have kind of modified the interleukin-2 such that patients really don't get that sick and they don't need to go to the intensive care unit. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your new approach. to that treatment?
Yeah, this actually stemmed from necessity. A few years ago, when we wanted to do interleukin 2, it turned out that we don't have enough available intensive care unit beds to admit patients on a regular basis to give the interleukin 2 in the intensive care. Now, it has been given 3 times a day at the National Cancer Institute and at other places, and we think that's just the way the regimen was developed. Nobody ever tried to see what happened if you give it twice a day. So we started giving it twice a day. It turns out that it makes no difference. Response rates are the same. We've done a little bit better, although that might just be chance. But certainly we're seeing a nice share of responses. The therapy is given on the floor. We have to transfer patients to the intensive care unit approximately 10% of the time if they get into trouble, but that's much easier than putting 100% of the patients in the intensive care unit.
So, Harriet, are there other treatments available for melanoma? I know that you've been involved in some investigational trials with some drugs and even maybe some oral therapies.
Yes, there are other drugs that we're looking at. There are two ways, really, to treat the cancer cells in melanoma. You can either activate the immune system to attack the cancer cells, or you can try and take a drug that attacks the cancer cells themselves. Now, chemotherapy, in the classic sense, the chemotherapy that everybody hears about that makes people nauseous and makes the hair fall out and so on, typically attacks cancer cells in a nonspecific way, and it can also affect other cells in the body, and that's why we have those side effects. Over the past years, the drug companies have been developing drugs that target specific molecules within the melanoma cells that are important for driving those cells. And we've tried a few of them. We have a study with dasatinib. That's a pill that we give for metastatic melanoma. We've seen some responses on that. There's a drug called sorafenib that was given together with chemotherapy. The national study has just been completed, and over 800 patients were accrued. We're waiting for the results of that. But as we go along, we're going to see more and more of these specific biological therapies that actually attack the immune cells. We want to be one of the places that is at the forefront of doing that. And one of the drives of the melanoma unit is actually to learn more about the melanoma cells, what makes them metastasize, what makes them aggressive, so that if we can identify those particular markers, we can then develop drugs that attack those proteins that are so important in moving this engine of metastasis forward. I think the big difficulty in that, it's not really a homogenous disease, it's a very heterogeneous disease, and every patient is different. And we're going to just end up having subsets of patients that are going to respond to certain therapies, and different patients we're going to have to come up with other solutions for.
Harriet, I think one of the really unique aspects of the melanoma team that we have here at the Cancer Center is that it really is made up of research scientists working together hand in hand with clinical investigators, and it's really been a very successful model, so much so that, in fact, your team recently received a very large grant from the National Cancer Institute. It's actually called the Melanoma Spore, which we're quite proud of. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about, you know, how this team works to really try to develop new treatment strategies from the laboratory and bring them into the clinic.
So I just have to correct you. It's the Yale Spore in Skin Cancer, because if someone turns on the radio and hears that it's only melanoma, they may be upset. It's not only for melanoma. It's for other skin cancers as well. And I think credit for getting this award goes to Dr. Ruth Halaban, who's our basic scientist, who's been coming to the melanoma meetings and tumor boards that we talked about earlier for the past decade at least. And she really sits there and listens to the patient presentations, makes sure that she gets tissue from all the patients so she can grow the cells in the lab, and then studies the cells. And she really has pushed this group together and pushed the grant writing. So SPORE stands for Special Programs of Research Excellence. It's a National Cancer Institute grant. It's around, I think, $2 million a year. It's a very nice size of a chunk of money. And it goes to a lot of investigators across the institution. And thanks to this particular grant, we've been able to bring in researchers from other departments who in the past might not have been that interested in melanoma, but they're now working on melanoma. So the SPORE group gets together frequently. We've been very fortunate in that because of the SPORE funding, we've been able to obtain other money as well for research.
Well, great. Well, it's amazing how quickly the time has gone, and hopefully we'll have you back on a future show to hear more about what's going on with the melanoma team and the spore in skin cancer, which is finally known as the melanoma spore. You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'd like to thank our guest expert, Dr. Harry Kluger, for joining us this evening. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.